Welcome to the Sanctuary Podcast, hosted by Angel Deer. In this podcast, we explore the mysteries of spirituality and consciousness. In each episode, we dive deep into the realms of human experiences, our rapidly changing world, and the unseen realms, tapping into the universal wisdom that connects us all. Whether you're a seasoned spiritual seeker, starting to awaken to the possibilities of a more expansive reality, or want support on your journey, this podcast is for you. Join me as we explore topics such as shamanism, spiritual transformation, holistic healing, the medicine path, energy healing, plant medicine, ancient wisdom, and more. Our guests are respected elders and experts in their fields, and we'll learn from their insights and experiences as we journey together on the path of spiritual growth. If you can, please consider supporting this podcast by joining our Patreon page at patreon.com/thesanctuaryny. Once again, it is patreon.com/thesanctuaryny. Now, let's dive into today's episode.
And so she gathered the plants and the potatoes. She would sing to them as a form of kind of sacred reciprocity. And that was really powerful for me to witness that. And she also talked to me about the song lines. And so for Australian Aboriginal people, they all believe that the earth contains inherent music. And they call that music the song lines. And song lines are just a beautiful central part of all Australian Aboriginal cosmology. And song lines are actually also called dreaming tracks. And they follow these songs, which are also like sacred pathways that trace across the ecology, trace across the sky. And these songs are the musical and symbolic language of the land. And they're really connected to the dream time, to the ancestors. They're very complex, very connected to sacred spots on the land for Aboriginal people.
Hello, everyone, and welcome for another episode here of the Sanctuary podcast and YouTube interviews. I'm really excited of this interview with Sarah West today. I've been following Sarah's book that I really love for, I think, over a year. Love the photos, love what Sarah does. And we are going to talk about the wilderness today, which is a theme that is very dear to my heart and our connection to nature. And Sarah has an amazing experience. And, you know, she spent some time with native communities and the Bushmen and Australian origin people. And so I think we're up for a great talk. So good afternoon, Sarah. How are you doing?
I'm doing well.
Yeah, good to be with you. So where are you? Where are you located? Because I know we wanted to do this outside, but you said to me it's very windy today. So where are you today?
Yeah, so I live in Moab, Utah. It's a very small town, but a lot of people come to explore the wilderness around Moab.
So can you describe me a bit the landscape? What is it over there for people that don't already know the landscape? I love it, but...
Okay. So it's a part of the Colorado Plateau, which encompasses all of southern Utah, parts of Arizona and New Mexico and Colorado. That's all part of the Colorado Plateau. And Moab is right in the Colorado Plateau. And it's all red rock desert wilderness. And there's many national parks nearby, canyonlands, arches, lots of places, beautiful canyons, and lots of rock climbing, and it's a beautiful place to live.
Yeah, I've been to Arches, and I still have amazing, vivid vision from that time there. So how long have you been living there, and what brought you there?
Yeah. So I've been living in the Moab area for 15 years now, and I first came out here. I was working as an archaeologist for Moab, and so that kind of got me just fascinated and intrigued with this landscape and why I came down here. And I've just ended up staying for a long time and working out here and living out here. And yeah, it's an amazing place to be.
Yeah. So in your kind of a little description of you, you say you're a naturalist, therapist, and nature guide. So we're going to go into that relationship with the wild, but I would like to go back a little bit in time, in your childhood, and tell me a little bit about little Sarah or young Sarah. Maybe you were tall. But were you always deeply connected to nature and you always knew kind of this was going to be your path to be guiding people in those landscape, or is it something that came later in your life?
Yeah, what a great question. So I grew up in Salt Lake City, which is Utah's capital city. But for a short period of time, my family moved down to southern Utah in a very small town in the desert. And so for 2 years, I lived out here in the desert, and my backyard was just empty wilderness. And so as a little 8-year-old, all I wanted to do was go out and explore the desert by myself. And I would just walk out my back door and wander around and really connect to the land and connect to the stones and the ravens. And that's really what got me connected to the land. So very young. I actually preferred to be by myself out wandering than, you know, doing other things that most other little kids would be doing.
Mm. Did you have an animal spirit or a special rock or a special streams? Or what was the one thing that you felt very connected to at the time?
Yeah, well, I've always been connected to ravens, definitely even from a very early age. And I had some special stones as a kid that I would go. And, you know, the rocks out here create these little crevices that you can kind of crawl in. So I had this kind of stone alcove that I would go crawl in as a kid and just feel like it was my little home.
Mm. Your first teacher, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, we're going to come back to this connection to land, but I want to open the discussion on your connection to beef communities. And I know you spent some time with Bushmen and with Aboriginal people in Australia on those lands. And so could you talk a little bit about those experiences and what you learned there and also what brought you there? Because it's kind of two very different places on the earth and it's quite far from where you are right now.
Yeah. So in college, I studied anthropology and archaeology and also human evolutionary ecology. And so for my master's project, I actually was studying the evolution of the human diet and looking at indigenous people's use of wild potatoes and how it relates to the grandmother hypothesis, which is this really amazing hypothesis developed by this woman who was my mentor in college, who I'm not going to really go into the hypothesis, but it's really fascinating. People can look it up. It's about how grandmothers were instrumental in our evolution and grandmothers who were digging potatoes. So that's a central part of the hypothesis. So I was working with Indigenous people, actually Indigenous people in California, collecting wild potatoes with them at our research site. And then we had Australian Aboriginal people actually come from Australia to our research site in California. We were working with some people in Stanford who had some funding to bring them over. And so I got to spend a week, this amazing, just incredible week. You know, I think I was 25 at the time, collecting wild potatoes with an Australian Aboriginal grandmother. And she was so beautiful. And it was really such a formative experience of my life to be out there on the land with her and, you know, gathering potatoes. And her daughter was there, so she could kind of translate a little bit what she was speaking about. And so she would, when she gathered the plants and the potatoes, she would sing to them as a form of kind of sacred reciprocity. And that was really powerful for me to witness that. Mm-hmm. And she also talked to me about the song lines. And so for Australian Aboriginal people, they all believe that the earth contains inherent music, and they call that music the song lines. And song lines are just a beautiful central part of all Australian Aboriginal cosmology. And song lines are actually also called dreaming tracks. Mm. And they follow these songs, which are also like sacred pathways that trace across the ecology, trace across the sky. And these songs are the musical and symbolic language of the land. And they're really connected to the dream time, to the ancestors. They're very complex, very connected to sacred spots on the land for Aboriginal people. And yeah, so I learned that at a very young age. And now that I'm much older, I often, when I kind of can sink below the level of my thinking mind, I can hear the land kind of dreaming in music, and I'll kind of follow the song to the place where I will make art. So I'm also an artist and I am a photographer. And so I follow the dreaming tracks to the place where I will photograph or write a poem or do a dance. And that's my way of kind of tending to that reciprocity with the land and to the songs that I hear.
That is so, so beautiful. So what do you mean is when you go in the wild today, you walk around and, you know, I know those lands are massive and expand beyond what the eye can see. Last time I was there, it was like such an incredible experience to see the breadth of the lands. So I guess your map is following those dream tracks, those song lines. So can you talk a little bit about how did you develop that? And I know it's very hard to put into words, and I know what I'm asking you is almost impossible. But yeah, maybe what does that feel like when you go on a trail, when you go on an adventure and say, I'm going to go there, and how you're guided and what's your intentionality and connection there?
That's beautiful. Yeah. So often I don't plan every. So first of all, let me just say every night I go out and I wander. I don't know where I'm going. I just go out the door and I kind of close my eyes for a moment and I try to hear, and it might not even be a song, but it's like a feeling inside of me. It's maybe my imagination, and I'll feel a song. Maybe I'll even hear it. Sometimes I do hear it, but sometimes it's just feeling it, and it's feeling the pathway. And then I'll just start wandering, and then I'll wander for some time. Sometimes it's even getting in my car and driving to Canyonlands. Sometimes the song lines will take me to Canyonlands or somewhere else in the desert. And then I'll know when to stop. There's a sense of this is where the song is ending. And then that's the moment where I'll just commune with whatever is in that place, whether it's a stone or a raven or a tree, a juniper tree, a cave, perhaps. I'll stop and just spend time sitting in that place and really being into a sacred communion.
I can just feel it. And I know you want to be alone, but I'd love to be there too. And it's interesting because that's something that I've heard from different traditional cultures, right? This development of the listening that is going before the talking and before the mind, right? It's this really fine tuning into the land. So I know you also spent time with a bushman, which is, I've never been there. I've been to Australia, but it's been, you know, one of my long dreams to go spend time with that. So can you talk a little bit about that experience and how, I'm sure there are similarities and also big differences. What brought you there? What did you learn from those beautiful people?
Yeah. So first I'll just say, when I was a child, I watched the film called The Gods Must Be Crazy. And a lot of people might have seen this film. It came out in the 80s, I think.
That's why I want to go. That's one of the reasons that told me to go a long time ago. Yes.
I love that movie as a kid. I watched it over and over again. I was transfixed with it. And so I think that already kind of planted a seed in me, the Bushmen. And those particular people in that film were the Jukwazi, who are the actual people who I went and did some work with. And what brought me there and into the Kalahari to be with them was the research I was doing with Indigenous people's use of wild potatoes. So I went out there and collected wild potatoes with them. It was just absolutely beautiful to do that in a completely different landscape. So in the Kalahari, and learn about kind of their Indigenous ways of collecting wild foods. But what was actually even more fascinating to me at the time than collecting wild food was their dancing ceremonies. And that was incredibly powerful to be out there. And I got to participate in some of their dancing rituals. So for the Bushmen are known as a dancing people. everything they do connects to dancing and movement and the body. They relate to everything from nature to healing ceremony is all done through dance. And so the shamans, who are both male and female, will lead the group into all night dancing, dancing trance kind of ceremonies. And the shamans will dance, and the more they dance, they're building up what they call nam, which is chi or prana. It's kind of building up that energy. And once they build up enough energy, and they'll do a lot of dancing and also shaking the body. They do a lot of body shaking, this kind of ecstatic movement. Well, the shamans, once they build up enough nam, then they'll do hands-on body work with people. Mm. Once they have the energy in their hands, they'll touch people. And I got to watch them do this. I got to watch them dance and then touch people and see the kind of the healing work happen in place. And it was so powerful and profound for me to be there dancing with them and then to see this dancing ceremony and their healing, ancient healing practices that they've been doing for so long. In fact, the Bushmen are considered one of the oldest living cultures in the world. Mm-hmm. Their click language is one of the oldest. Linguists have actually traced it to be one of the oldest languages in the world. And as well as, you know, their archaeology. So they have some of the oldest artifacts in the world. And so it was amazing to really see this from some of the very earliest people that were around.
Yeah, it's interesting because, yeah, it was this very unique language that we hear in the movie, and that made me feel so captivated because it's so different from, obviously many human languages are different, but the language of the Bushmen, of those Bushmen, is so different. That's like very, I don't know, that I guess it's a time portal onto the Earth's history.
Absolutely. Yeah, it was one of my things was just to listen to them speak. And the people I was spending time with, none of them spoke English. They were real, more traditional hunter-gatherers. And although a lot of Bushmen are learning English, moving into towns, they're being pushed off their land. It's really so heartbreaking. But some of them are still traditionally hunting and gathering. So I had a translator who would translate. But I just absolutely loved listening to them speak. And I truly felt them as some of the happiest people I've ever met in my life. Just kind of the energy that they had just was so, it touched me so deeply. And the Bushmen are egalitarian. So that means that they all kind of have equal power. And I love to see the men taking care of the children. And I love that the females are also the shamans. And so just this beautiful human group with kind of equal rights. This was so beautiful to be immersed in.
So beautiful. So here you are back in Moab, back in Turtle Island, what we call North America. And obviously our relationship to lands, colonizer as Western people, seems completely on the opposite of the pendulum from those two cultures that you described and the people you talk to. And so, you know, I wonder in terms of your work today, let's talk a little bit about what you're doing and how do you bring this into a format or into a way that is, you know, accessible and also invite people to a deeper reflection on our connection to land and that sacred relationship to land that we've lost. I mean, aside from Native American people and that still, you know, have those deep roots, but for most people, it can feel very foreign to follow a song line, to dance those energies, right? Even the idea, I guess, of going into trance states through dancing, which is pretty common in Africa. I mean, in many tribal cultures, it's not something that is unusual, but how do we, and is it something you're interested in also, to how do we bridge people back into authenticity and in terms of connection to land and, yeah, returning to the self in the same time?
Yeah, this is such a beautiful question. Well, I think I do that, first of all, through just describing my own personal experience that I write about and share. You've obviously been following me on social media, and I have people all the time write to me saying, I'd never once talked to a raven, but I read something you wrote and I started talking to a raven. Or I slept under the stars one night because I read about something you discussed. And so I think it's these little steps of just doing, you know, going up to a tree and maybe sitting with it for a while and seeing if you can listen to what it has to say, or actually read a poem to a tree. Or I think there's lots of little ways that people can start to practice this sacred reciprocity with land and this sacred kind of connecting that they might not be familiar with.
Yeah, I feel, you know, like everybody's somehow craving that, even if many people don't know it's what they are craving. I did a post on our Facebook page a few weeks ago about a tree being cut, an elder tree. And I mentioned there, I say, I wish people talked to the tree before and ask the tree for permission and ask, you know, the story of that elders. Somehow by the magic or the pain, I don't know if social media, this post went viral. And it got seen by over 5 million people, which is completely crazy. But obviously it got also into the whole crowd that says you're insane and you're crazy. Tree don't talk. And what are you talking about? And people got, in fact, it was interesting to see the amount of, on one side, anger and sadness for the tree being cut. And people say, wow, I feel you. And it's happened to me there and there. People from all over the world. But also a big part of the crowd that were really angry and aggressive that I could post something like that. And it really made me, you know, not wanting to answer anyway, but just sit with it and feel, wow, some people are really seeing the world in such a different way and don't have that connection. And how much of that pain do they carry in them by disconnecting from what we are, because we are ultimately part of nature.
Yeah.
So what's your experience with that? And maybe, obviously, you know, I'm sure people that reach out to you, people are interesting and curious and, you know, about what you do, but is it something you witness? I don't know, maybe in your family as you grew up, or maybe in relations, and you have to kind of filter through what you want it to be or what you want it to become and embody authenticity for yourself, right? What I wonder is, how do you navigate this authenticity of your deep connection to nature and relationship to land in a world that is sometimes not just not interested in it, but very aggressive or against it? And do you ever have to navigate that, or it's not something you experience ever in your family, even in, I would think, the science academic world that you come from, right? As an archaeologist and research anthropologist, right? Is there a moment where, well, I'm more interested in that, it seems to provide more meaning, and push back and say, this is not science, this is not true, right?
So I think, you know, for the most part, I think people respect my way of being. And so I don't personally get a lot of pushback, although occasionally I'll share something. And the little scientist in me who, you know, spent years as a scientist collecting data, and, you know, that rationalist part that I had for many years will get a little bit scared sharing something that I share. And, but I have to just kind of honor that part, tend to it for a moment. But really, I feel it's so important to share how I really feel about the natural world, that I have these kind of maybe animistic sensibilities that, you know, for 99% of all human evolution, we were animistic. And we didn't even need the word animism, right? Because animism is an anthropological construct. And before we even needed the word, it's just how everybody was. And I think because I have that deep connection studying so many Indigenous people cross-culturally, that I feel so akin to that wisdom and how kind of we've always been that way for so long. And maybe even those people that reject it, maybe there's just a little something or another that gets through to them. Maybe something, they remember something inside of them, that a time that maybe they feel when their own ancestors at some point were that way and connected in a more sacred way.
Yeah, I felt that. Thank you for sharing that. So I want to descend into a cave and talk about the caves, because I know you have experiences with cave, and it's part of the, I guess, sacred places, special place that I've called you there. So my teacher in Peru, you know, when we hike the mountains, when there is a cave, there's a lot of respect for caves. And in Quechua, in the ancient Andean language, they call the caves the here of the earth. This is where she's listening. And so there's always a protocol. We don't just enter a cave because it's entering, you know, the here of your mother, and you have to be careful how you talk and how you enter it. And I always love that. And there's also a plant in Peru in the mountain that only grows at the entrance of cave, right on the outside. And I've always felt this plant was kind of the little guardians, right, of this entrance. So anyway, I've always had this connection, but I would love you to share your experience with cave and maybe some visionary experience that you have had there, and why caves, and what attracts you. And maybe that little girl in that cracks that you mentioned in the beginning, yeah. And you wanted to go in the bigger one, but what is it that is calling you there, and what is your experience with those caves?
Yeah, thank you so much for sharing that beautiful image of the Peruvian people you've spent time with, calling it the ear of the earth. And I love that they talk about asking permission to enter, because that's exactly what I do. I have a particular cave here on the land near my home that I connect with almost every day. I go into this cave, and every time before I enter the cave, I bow. I ask permission to enter every time. And I wait a moment and wait to feel if it's okay. And it usually always is, but I always do that just as a gesture and to honor the spirits of the cave. And then I go into the cave and I sit, and I will sit and listen to the spirits of the cave. I'll often say hello to the spiders of the cave. There's quite a number of black widows in this particular cave that I go into. And over the years of going to this cave for, you know, several years now, I've become good friends with the black widows, and feel that, you know, black widows have been very sacred for the indigenous people. So this land was the homeland of the Hopi and the Diné, as well as the Numix speakers, the Goshute, Paiute, Shoshone, and Ute. And and for the Hopi, they have a lot of beautiful mythologies around Grandmother Spider. And Spider was one of the most important creator beings of the land. And so I go and I talk to the spiders, and I particularly like black widows. They're very quiet and shy, and they won't really harm you. And so I often do that. And I just had my first wilderness vigil many years ago, had a really incredibly profound mystical experience, a visionary experience, where I was out on the land. I had actually completed my solo part of my vigil, and I had returned to the group. This was done in a group setting, and it was the last night before we were all about to leave to go back home. Well, I couldn't sleep that night, and I was just up, and I heard an owl right next to me in the tree above me where I was camping. We were in a very remote canyon in southern Utah here, in a place called Bear's Ears, which is a very sacred land for the indigenous people of Utah. And I'd been listening to this owl, and then I just quickly went into a visionary experience. And it was very static, so I felt it deeply in my body, and as well as in my imagination and in kind of my visual part of my being. And I felt the owl come into my body at that point. And it felt very real. It felt like it swooped into my mouth, and I started turning into an owl. And anybody who would have been around me, everybody else was asleep, I was kind of away from the group, would have seen me contorting my body. And changing, I felt myself changing into an owl. And nothing like that had ever happened to me before. Nothing. And then the experience shifted to where I saw myself and the owl together in a cave. And we started going down into the chamber of the cave. And I was really scared because it was very dark. But I had this sense to keep going, and me and the owl went all the way to the back of the cave, and something some voice said it was the cave of forgotten dreams. And all of a sudden my hands started glowing with light, and I was able to use my hands to shine a light onto the cave wall where there was all this ancient rock art. And I was able to see some of the most beautiful and oldest rock art in the entire world. And there was a sense after that. So the vision ended at that point. And when I kind of came back, when the vision ended and I came back, there was a sense that that was kind of a soul vision of what my work is in the world, to shine the light on people's kind of the lost art of their soul. But that's part of my gifts as a healing practitioner, is to help people to be their guide into their own cave of forgotten dreams.
Yeah, I was just wanting to take a breath there and pause. It's just so, so beautiful. So Sarah, so let's talk about today and the work you do. I think it's a good transition. So you mentioned the wilderness vigils and that first amazing experience that you had. So can you talk a little bit more about them and maybe anything else that that vision and obviously everything else that you've done before brought you here to do, and how you are manifesting that into the world today? And now, yeah, you're bringing it to life. And, you know, one thing is to have a vision. Another one is to bring it to life, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I'll just finish that by saying, since I had that vision years ago, I decided at that point to kind of apprentice to caves. So now for the last many years now, I've been going into caves and to try to understand that vision a little bit more. And so that's kind of why I'm still tending to caves and learning about caves and sitting in caves. And I'm also now a wilderness vigil guide and lead wilderness vigils here in Moab. I lead solo one-on-one wilderness vigils as well as group vigils. And the wilderness vigil is an immeasurably ancient ceremony. And most people probably know it by the term vision quest. I tend to not use the word vision quest anymore because of cultural appropriation. And I really like the word vigil because it means being awake in prayer. And it's just so simple and so beautiful, being awake in prayer for a certain amount of time. And that so resonates with what I feel these are. So it's a time that so many of our ancestors would go off into the wilderness to find meaning, to find clarity and healing, as well as to find kind of your authentic place in the world. And a wilderness vigil can be wonderfully ecstatic. It can be grief-filled. It can be terrifying. It can be filled with heightened emotion and perhaps a mystical encounter. And so it's ultimately an initiation of transformation. So whoever goes on these is bound to have a shift happen, a life-changing shift. And generally fasting, traditionally fasting, is done for 3 or 4 nights alone. Although I will add that I myself used to fast when I did these, but I no longer fast. I'll eat lightly. I feel like for me, as a woman and as a mother, I've already gone through a really powerful rite of passage myself into motherhood. And for me, fasting doesn't really seem like it's necessary for me to have a really deep, profound experience on my vigil. However, for a lot of people, fasting can be deeply, richly symbolic, as well as it creates an altered state. So when I lead these, I tend to tell people to listen to their own body and to fast if they're feeling called to, or to eat lightly and to really just really listen to their own body's wisdom.
That is so beautiful. Thank you. Yeah. And thank you for also this name that you came up with. I think it's really beautiful and resonates, and also the respectful reason that you're doing that. I think it's really, really important. So I want to close this discussion and talk a little bit about art and photos and maybe dance. I don't know, any kind of sacred expression. Your photos, and people that are listening here on YouTube or or our podcast, I invite you to look under the description here and check out Sarah's photos. But there's something really profound about those photos. And I wonder, how is that part of the message you want to share? How is that an integral part of this sacred reciprocity with them, connection to those old voices, returning to the probably authentic self, right? That is beyond all the noise of the mind and society and culture. So how do you integrate the arts in general into that? And how do you see maybe as a key part of your work and of who you are?
Yeah, that's so beautiful. Yeah, so I often think of myself as an intermediary between the human world and the natural world. And I've been living and working out in wilderness and the edge of wilderness for 20 years now. And I have such a deep and meaningful connection with nature, and I always have. And art is part of my communion. It's part of my connection. And it's done in a really reciprocal way where all, you know, I'm not just out photographing in a quick way. I'm not out just to get the best shot. I'm out and I'm actually speaking to the beings that I'm photographing. And I'm out actually in a rich conversation. So it's all a sacred conversation. All the art that I do is a sacred conversation, whether it's photography. Sometimes I go out with my easel and I'll paint. I also will, as you mentioned, dance. I'll dance with the elements. I love dancing with the wind. I'll dance with the sunset. Again, it's me saying, I see your beauty. I honor your beauty. And I'm going to offer you beauty back as my way of tending to that reciprocity with the earth. And then often I'll bring all that back into the human realm, and I'll bring that back into the human world. And so often it will inspire other people to want to have their own kind of more intimate connection with nature and with that kind of more than human world.
Beautiful. Thank you, Sarah. I feel the deep reverence here. Yeah, the deep, deep love, devotion. You know, I think that's the word I was looking for, deep devotion to this, those wild spaces, those ancient voices. So thank you so much for that. So before we end the conversation here, so if people, you know, how do people connect to your work? What can they do? Obviously, they'll find your email here and website and all of that. But do you want to talk a little bit about your offerings? I mean, you said wilderness vigils, but anything else that you want to mention for people to connect with you?
Yeah. So yeah, I do wilderness vigils, either one-on-one vigils out here in Moab, also group wilderness vigils. I also lead kind of healing retreats where I do kind of more trauma-based healing work as a therapist. I do body work. I do therapy. I do nature-based connection, nature-based soul work as well out here in Moab. I also do it online with people, and they can find all that information on my website. And I also am a photographer, and I do portrait work. If someone wants to come out here and get their portraits made in a kind of a more sacred way, I'm really kind of gifted at bringing someone's kind of soulful essence out in photography, so they can also come out to do some photo work with me.
Beautiful. Thank you, Sarah. Thank you for this conversation, this dive. I want to know much more. I definitely want to go sit in that cave at some point one day. And yeah, thank you so much for bringing all your wisdom in such a very loving way. And also I feel the fire and I feel the earth, you know, I feel the feminine, and I also feel this fiery, you know, arrow into that devotion. And that's really beautiful to experience with you. Thank you so much for the talk today. Thank you everyone for joining. I hope you enjoyed the conversation as much as I did, or even more, who knows. And I look forward to seeing you all again soon. Bye, Sarah. Thank you so much.
So much.
Thank you for listening to the Sanctuary Podcast. We deeply value your support. Please consider sharing this podcast with others and joining our Patreon page at patreon.com/thesanctuaryny. Once again, it is patreon.com/thesanctuaryny. At The Sanctuary, we believe that spirituality is a personal journey that takes many forms. and we honor and respect all paths to awakening and the rise of consciousness. Our mission is to provide a platform for open and honest conversations about spirituality and to inspire and empower our listeners to live their most authentic lives in good relation to each other's, the living and invisible worlds. I look forward to connecting with you again here or at our events, retreats, and online gatherings. You can find all our offerings at thesanctuaryheal.com. Once again, it is thesanctuaryheal.com.